The damage is devastating, and our hearts are still breaking. My administration is committed, absolutely committed, to ensuring that the parties responsible for this tragedy pay to repair the damage and be held accountable to the fullest extent the law will allow.
The fullest extent the law will allow, and there is the rub, isn't it, Mr. President?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
We'll talk about that today.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We will be talking about the Titanic Law. That's sort of what you heard President Biden referring to at the top of the show there. The Titanic Law is now coming into play in Congress, and yes, in Maryland, in specifically in Baltimore, Maryland. I will explain shortly. Hopefully no one has gone blind today trying to view Monday's eclipse.
Yes, hopefully no one has gone blind for that.
Viewable across the nation, and specifically a total eclipse of the sun for about 4 minutes all the way from Maine to Texas. We caught part of it out here, Desi Doyen. What was it, about 60% coverage?
Yes,
in
it was.
Los
it was
Angeles?
Very cool.
It was, but not as cool as it might have been in the middle of the country. Well, in the parts of the country where the totality existed. But of course, despite being a perfectly natural and yes, totally predictable phenomenon, that did not prevent some of our far right elected officials from making asses of themselves yet again. Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted out over the weekend, quote, "God is sending America strong signs to tell us to repent. Earthquakes and eclipses and many more things to come. I pray that our country listens." Now, Community Notes on Twitter, which adds its response to at least some of the utter BS that now pervades Elon Musk's website. Community Notes responded to say, along with links, to say, quote, "There are approximately 1,700 earthquakes in the U.S. every year, about 4 a day. And solar eclipses occur approximately every 18 months and are able to be predicted well in advance. Hundreds of thousands of years in advance. In fact, now, no, it ain't a sign from God, though I could see why uneducated tribal communities hundreds and hundreds of years ago may have seen it as such. How a grown-up, supposedly educated, elected member of Congress in 2024 Could see it as such. Well, that's a different matter, it seems to me.
Well, there's really no science that the MAGA Republicans will not try to change, yes, mess up, and
ignore,
politicize.
Disagree with, yeah. Yes, politicize. The Community Notes account includes a link to a Wikipedia page listing, for example, the next 175 such solar eclipses, exactly when they will exist, going out as far as the year 2186. When we still may be waiting for Donald Trump's indictments to actually go to trial, but we will see. It's moving closer today. News breaking just as we go to air that the New York courts have rejected his latest attempt to delay his criminal trial, which is to start about 1 week from today on April 15, Monday. As to those many more things to come, however, that Marjorie Taylor Greene mentions, well, she's likely right about that. That part, especially given the climate change crisis that she has been actively working hard to do nothing about for years now, I suspect she will have quite a bit of repenting herself to do someday for that. Now, I didn't bother to look up whether Marjorie Taylor Greene felt that the recent collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore was also a warning sign from God or not. But I would hardly be surprised if that's how she categorized that deadly disaster as well. I suppose it could be a sign from God, or it could be a sign that Maryland's former Republican governor turned U.S. Senate candidate Larry Hogan did not listen to myriad warnings from critics about the safety dangers of larger ships being allowed to come into the port of Baltimore despite clear safety warnings against doing so. We will be joined momentarily by an investigative reporter who has been looking into both that and the 173-year-old law that has come to be known as the Titanic Law, which Republican lawmakers have refused to reform. It was actually adopted before the Titanic tragedy, believe it or not. But Republican lawmakers have refused to reform it when it comes to big ships and tankers in order to protect the major shipping interests, which, yes, include madly profitable oil companies that do not want to see that law reformed so that they might actually, you know, be held accountable for such preventable disasters. That's what you heard President Biden sort of referring to there at the top of the show. We'll get to that in a bit. But first, a bit of news, in this case, some election news out of the great state of Ohio, much of which, as I understand it, had a good view of the eclipse totality on Monday, at least where weather allowed it in any event, via the Columbus Dispatch. Frank LaRose, Ohio's Republican Secretary of State, is warning that President Joe Biden will not make it onto the general election ballot in Ohio this year unless either a state law is changed or the Democratic National Convention moves their convention to meet earlier this year than currently planned. The Secretary of State's office sent a letter on Friday to Ohio's Democratic Party chairwoman, Liz Walter, that alerted her to the issue. So what's the issue exactly? And how could this actually be an issue? Well, I mean, could Ohio keep President Biden off the ballot in the Buckeye State this November? Well, according to the dispatch, the Democratic National Convention meets on August 19 to nominate its candidate for president, but Ohio law sets a deadline of August 7 to certify presidential candidates for the November ballot. The convention would have to meet earlier this year, which is unlikely given the, you know, planning and logistics, or the Ohio General Assembly could pass legislation that grants a waiver, according to this letter sent to Walters. But they would have to do so, grant such a waiver, by May 9, according to LaRose. Quote, please contact me as soon as possible with any information that can assure this office of timely compliance with Ohio law, wrote Paul DeSantis, chief legal counsel for the Ohio Secretary of State. Spokesperson for Walters and the state Democrats said, quote, we're looking into it. Now, the DNC does not happen until August 19 in Chicago, after the state's August 7 deadline, whereas the Republican National Convention, that's scheduled to begin the month before on July 15 in Milwaukee. So they don't run into this problem, though they did run into it back in 2020 when apparently it was no problem at all. Both major parties. Yes, both major parties back in 2020 had scheduled their conventions for after Ohio's statutory deadline, which requires the nominee named 90 days before the election. Knowing this problem was in the offing, state lawmakers, way back in 2019, went ahead and just made a change to the law. They added a one-time-only change, shortening the deadline to just 60 days before the deadline before the election instead of 90 days. But now that it's Democrats only that will run into the problem this year, you see how this is working.
Yeah.
It's unthinkable, in fact, that Ohio Republicans would block the president of the United States from appearing on the state ballot because of this. I think it's unthinkable that after pretending that it was an outrage that some jurisdictions around the country wanted to, you know, follow the very specific words of the Constitution's 14th Amendment that actually does bar Donald Trump from the ballot after having engaged in insurrection on January 6th of 2021, that was actually prevented, even though it's very clear in the Constitution that was prevented by the corrupt Trump-appointed majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. So surely Republicans would not simply keep Biden off the ballot from the 2024 ballot, right? Because
of a state law
that is actually ridiculous, right?
Yes.
We will see. But it does seem worth putting on your radar today amid all of the madness. And speaking of Joe Biden.
I'll just say real quick, yes, if you know somebody in Ohio, yeah, maybe contact them and tell them to contact
their state legislature
and let them know what they want them to do.
Anyway, back to what I kind of want to say back to reality here, but who knows? Who knows what they're going to do in Ohio? President Joe Biden said on Monday that college graduates would see, quote, life-changing relief from his new plan to ease debt burdens for more than 30 million borrowers. In the latest attempt by the Democratic president to make good on a campaign promise that could buoy his standing with young voters after the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court blocked him from forgiving some $400 billion in student loan debt for 42 million Americans last year. That despite the same court allowing Trump to use the very same law that Biden tried to use to change the federal student loan agreements for Americans at the height of the pandemic. Biden was speaking, made this announcement on Monday in Wisconsin.
Even when they have worked hard and pay their student loans, their debt increases, not diminishes. Too many people feel the strain and stress, wondering if they're going to get married, have their first child, start a family, because even if they get by, they still have this crushing, crushing debt. That's not the, you know, it's not just a drag on them. It's a drag on our local economies. It's a drag on, no, it really is. It's a drag on the economies.
Biden went on to detail the new initiative, which has been in the works for months. That was during a trip to Wisconsin on Monday. He said he wanted to, quote, give everybody a fair shot and freedom to chase their dreams, as he lamented the rising cost of higher education. Quote, even when they work hard and pay their student loans, their debt increases and not diminishes. That's what's been going on in this country for the last, decade or so. So Biden's new debt plan announced on Monday would expand federal student loan relief to new categories of borrowers through the Higher Education Act, which administration officials believe puts it on a stronger legal footing than the sweeping proposal that was killed by a 6-3 court majority last year. The new plan would cancel some or all federal student loans for more than 30 million Americans, according to the White House. The Education Department plans to issue a formal proposal for this in the coming months, with plans to start implementing parts of it as early as this fall. Now, whether that is in time to make a difference before the November elections, of course, that remains to be seen. President Biden will use, quote, every tool to cancel student loan debt for as many borrowers as possible, no matter how many times Republican elected officials try to stand in his way, said White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre in a call with reporters. Biden summarized how the new plan would work during his remarks on Monday in Wisconsin.
Today, I'm proud to announce 5 major actions to continue to relieve student debt for more than 30 million Americans since I started my administration. First, my administration will propose a new rule to cancel up to $20,000 in runaway interest for any borrower that owes more now than when they started paying the loan. And for low and middle class families enrolled in my SAVE program, we'll cancel all of your interest, all of your interest. Second, we plan to cancel student debt for borrowers who still owe student loans, even though they started repaying them more than 2 decades ago. Third, we plan to cancel debt for about 2 million borrowers who would be eligible for debt forgiveness through the SAVE program, public service loan forgiveness, or other debt canceling programs, but are not enrolled in these programs. Fourth, we plan to cancel debt for borrowers who the Department of Education determines were cheated by universities that left students on unaffordable loans and delivered little in benefits to students. And one of those colleges was closed. I won't mention it. And finally,
Trump University.
The Department of Education will propose a new rule to cancel student debt for Americans facing financial hardships, from child care to health care, to prevent them from paying back their loans. And over the coming months, the Department of Education will propose and then implement these plans. And starting this fall, we plan to deliver up to $20,000 in interest relief to over 20 million borrowers and full forgiveness for millions more. It's for the good of our economy. It's growing stronger and stronger, and it is. By freeing millions of Americans from this crushing debt of student debt, it means they can finally get on with their lives instead of their lives being put on hold. That's why every American making a student loan payment should go to studentaid.gov. studentaid.gov to learn more about these plans and see if any of them fit for you.
studentaid.gov. That was the president in Wisconsin on Monday. Hearings to craft the new rule wrapped up in February. Yes, passing adopting a rule takes much longer than a simple executive action, as he had tried to issue an executive order that was blocked by the Supreme Court last year. The Education Department will now issue a formal proposal, and it will be open to public comment before it can be finalized this fall. This new effort comes on the heels of several other programs implemented by the Biden administration that are already in effect, that have already forgiven student debt to millions of Americans since the court blocked his initial plan last year. It also comes as Biden is hoping to shore up support among younger voters, which, if you believe the polls these days, show many of them, for reasons that are sort of hard to wrap one's brain around at this point, say that they are moving to the Donald Trump side of the aisle, incredibly enough, again, if you believe the polling. So let's talk very quickly about that other guy for a minute before we get to my guest shortly, because you may have seen the headlines on this by now. They are all over the place in the mainstream media, and I should note, they are all wrong. NPR's headline, Trump declines to back nationwide abortion ban, says it should be left to the states. The New York Times on Monday, Trump says abortion law should be left to the states. CBS News, Donald Trump says abortion should be left up to the states. CNN, Trump says abortion legislation should be left to the states. And Washington Post, latest 2024 election news in new video, Trump says abortion should be, yes, left to the states. But that is not at all what Donald Trump actually said in a rambling sort of word salad of a video statement that was posted to his social media site on Monday, despite all of those NPR, New York Times, CBS, CNN, Washington Post all misreporting what the guy actually said. And you wonder why young voters, older voters, white, black, Hispanic, anybody else voters, are somehow backing Donald Trump. This is the kind of crap they see from the mainstream corporate media.
Yes, the corporate media taking the word salad that Trump says and turning it into something coherent that isn't actually even true.
That he didn't say. As Media Matters' Matt Gaetz correctly reports today, former President Donald Trump's strategy of ducking questions on abortion requires mainstream reporters to let him off the hook and leave pro-choice swing voters with the false impression that he is more moderate than he actually is. So far, reports Gaetz, it is working. Major news outlets are falsely claiming that Trump, in his Monday video, said abortion, quote, should be left to the states. But that's not what he said. In fact, Trump said only that abortion, quote, will be left to the states, a statement of current law that does not address how he would respond if Congress passed a federal abortion ban or how regulators would treat abortion under a second Trump administration. And that is key. But, you know, if he says it will be left up to the states, not really. Of course, you know, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022 with the help of Trump's three appointees, eliminating the constitutional right to abortion that has stood for nearly 50 years. The ruling paved the way for total and near-total abortion bans and related extreme policies in many Republican-controlled states, while creating a political vulnerability for the GOP, given the unpopularity of its position. So Trump is sort of hoping to have it both ways here. He obfuscated his actual position on abortion by first, in this video, taking credit for overturning Roe, and then said that going forward, quote, my view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint. He said that he actually said that both Republicans and Democrats and abortion rights proponents wanted Roe to be overturned. So that was the first bit of gaslighting. That, of course, is false. And he said the quote, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state. Many news outlets, Gaetz reports, including the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN.com and CBSNews.com and NPR.org, etc., all gave Trump the headline that he likely wanted by reporting that the former president had said abortion law, quote, should be left to the states. But that is not true. That is not what he said. He did not say whether he would, one way or another, whether he would sign a federal abortion ban if Congress passed it and it came to his desk as president. That's the question. Well, I was going to say it's the question that we all want to know, but I think it's the question that we all know the answer to. Of course he would. He's been talking about it for weeks. The only thing he wasn't sure about, oh, should it be 15 weeks? Should it be 16 weeks? And now he just chose not to mention that part. Nor did he say whether federal regulators at the FDA under his administration would move to ban medication abortions with mifepristone, as anti-choice advocates have been arguing, have argued all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. He did not say whether he would support restricting sending medication abortions through the mail under the 1850s or I don't know when it was, the Comstock Act, a federal law. Would they use that to block mifepristone from being sent through the mail?
And technically, as anti-abortion activists have been working toward, that could also be include birth control that's sent by mail.
Yeah. He didn't say anything about that either. He didn't say how he would vote, by the way, on the abortion referendum that is on the ballot in his home state of Florida this November. He didn't mention that, didn't talk about that, nor whether he will continue to appoint judges who will further curtail abortion rights. So that's all the stuff he didn't speak to while he got the headline that he wanted, that, oh, Trump says abortion should be left to the states. But that is not what he said. As Semaphore's Jordan Weissman explained on Twitter, if you actually listen to Trump's statement on abortion, he doesn't say should be left to the states. He says will be left to the states. It's just a statement of what the law is currently. He leaves unsaid what would happen if a ban crosses his desk. He also says, whatever they quote, whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the state, unquote. That, says Weissman, also is just a statement of fact. At some point, someone needs to ask, if Republicans pass a 15 or 16 week abortion ban in Congress, will you sign it or will you veto it? Likewise, folks need to ask about mifepristone and the mail. So, for instance, he cites this New York Times headline reading, Trump says abortion law should be left to the states, is incorrect. An accurate version would be, Trump acknowledges abortion law is up to states, does not explicitly say whether or not he would sign a ban. Responding to Weissman on Twitter, our friend Slate's Mark Joseph Stern wrote, it's not even a statement of what the law is. Trump's likely appointees like Roger Severino and Jonathan Mitchell say they interpret the Comstock Act already as a nationwide ban on all abortions and intend to enforce it in a second term. He says it goes beyond mifepristone. To them, the ban already exists. These are among the, unasked and unanswered questions by the once and perhaps future president that the, you know, incredibly enough, we ask, well, how is it that Donald Trump, and again, whether you believe the polls or not, how is it that Donald Trump could even come out ahead in any of the polls, given everything we know about this guy at this point? Well, one of the reasons is because much of the country is siloed into their right-wing media, and the rest of the country, who, you know, might come across real news from real news outlets, gets crapped like this from NPR and the New York Times and CBS and CNN and so forth. So I didn't even want to cover that statement when I heard about it originally until I saw everything that the media had ended up, how they had ended up covering it. So I felt like I needed to jump in here and mention that real
quick. And I just want to point out one more thing. Yep. Jonathan Mitchell, the one you just mentioned, who represented Trump before the Supreme Court, he had said recently anti-abortion activists, quote, should keep their mouths shut until the election. Back in February, he told the New York Times that anti-abortion strategists had purposely been quiet about their more advanced plans, given the political liability that the issue has become for Republicans.
Which he said, which Trump actually hinted at in a preview of his statement on Sunday when he said, you know, but we got to win elections. He sent a very clear message.
Yep.
Let me win this election and then we will do exactly what you want. All right, very quickly back to the other guy now who has, by the way, vowed to restore abortion rights if the American nationally, if the American people elect a Congress that can send him such a bill. And he has made his position, at least, very clear that he would not allow a national ban on reproductive rights, even if a Republican Congress were to send him a bill in a second term. That guy, Joe Biden, well, he was in Baltimore on Friday. He reiterated his vow to, quote, move heaven and earth to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge, quote, as rapidly as humanly possible. And he said with union labor and American-made steel, and to hold the companies responsible for this action to account. But at this point, it is unclear if the Republicans in Congress, who have been fighting for years to prevent such accountability for such companies, will allow any of that. Investigative journalist Helen Santoro has been digging pretty much since the collapse of the bridge 2 weeks ago into the efforts by Maryland's Republican former governor turned U.S. Senate candidate Larry Hogan to expand Baltimore's port to allow the type of mega vessel that caused the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, despite safety warnings from experts. And as following the lobbying efforts by the industry, including, yes, Big Oil, to ensure their GOP friends in Congress do not reform that 173-year-old Titanic law that limits their responsibility for such disasters. That story is next with Helen Santoro as she joins us to discuss it all. Next on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman.
Hi, this is Desi Doyen from the Green News Report and the Bradcast. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Last year, in early February, 38 freight train cars derailed in East Palestine, Ohio. The derailment triggered a massive fire, which belched thick plumes of toxic smoke into the air far above the small Republican-leaning town on the eastern edge of the state near the border of Pennsylvania, forcing the evacuation of nearby residents. 20 of the cars contained hazardous materials, including vinyl chloride, which was later set on fire in a controlled burn in hopes of preventing an even larger explosion. Congressional Republicans were outraged, of course, because it was a Republican-leaning town, and the disaster was an opportunity to blame President Joe Biden and his administration somehow. Even though scores of such toxic train derailments and disasters take place with regularity around the country each year, if not necessarily near Republican-leaning towns during a Democratic presidency. More than a year later, cleanup efforts at that site are still ongoing and the effects of the crash still linger. And yet, despite the GOP's pretend outrage about the incident, efforts have stalled in Congress to enact safety reforms on the nation's rail system to ensure safer transport of toxic materials and to protect communities from, yes, toxic train derailments. Shortly after the derailment, the Railway Safety Act in the U.S. Senate was introduced by Ohio's Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown and co-sponsored by Ohio's Republican Senator J.D. Vance. It proposed a number of reforms, including more detectors to signal when a train's wheel bearings were overheating, more thorough inspections, and improved emergency procedures so that first responders would know what substances they're dealing with and are better prepared to respond to a derailment more effectively. A similarly bipartisan bill was introduced in the U.S. House. But more than a year after the East Palestine derailment, both bills are gathering dust in Congress. Republican Senator John Thune of North Dakota, a former lobbyist for the rail industry himself, who is the number two Senate recipient of railroad lobbying dollars since 1990, said, quote, "This bill should have been about safety reforms relevant to the derailment in East Palestine, but now it's been expanded to a stalking horse for onerous regulatory mandates and union giveaways," he claimed. The rail industry, and therefore, yes, Republicans, are lobbying against a number of safety reforms in the legislation, including one that mandates at least a minimum two-person crew for such high-hazard trains. But, of course, the corporate rail industry opposes the need to hire even one more employee on such trains, even though they can sometimes stretch more than a mile in length, where one person is currently mandated to watch the entire train somehow. Congressman Chris DiLuzio, a Pennsylvania Democrat who sponsored the House version of the bill, recently told the Pennsylvania Capital Star that politicians were bending to pressure from the railroads. Quote, "I can't even get the Republican leadership to get us a hearing," DiLuzio complained in February, a full year after the disaster. "They're doing the bidding of the big railroads here at the expense of the good people I represent and our neighbors in Ohio and folks like us who live close to these tracks all over the country." But, of course, the GOP's pretend outrage over what happened in East Palestine has ebbed, as it didn't turn out to be quite the opportunity to blame the Biden administration that they had hoped, and especially after measures to prevent another such disaster might end up costing their friends in the rail industry a few more dollars. Well, it has only been barely 2 weeks, but now we are seeing, I think, a similar sequence of events unfold in response to the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore, Maryland, after it was struck by a massive, modern, supersized cargo ship at the end of March. On Monday, according to NBC News, recovery efforts at the site of the Key Bridge collapse reached what officials are describing as a critical step as crews began removing shipping containers from the vessel Dolly, the 980-foot mega container ship which caused the collapse when it lost power and crashed into the bridge 2 weeks ago. Removal of those containers will eventually allow crews to access a key portion of the roadway now perched above the containers on board the Singapore flagship, which caused the deaths of six roadway workers. Moving the ship itself eventually is important, as it would allow authorities to begin reopening the port to at least some traffic, according to officials. But days after a massive cargo ship collided with the Key Bridge, Republican U.S. Senate candidate and former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan called for the federal government to foot the bill for the bridge's reconstruction. Hogan's demands follows his efforts as Maryland's then-governor to attract such outsized vessels to Baltimore's ports in the first place, despite myriad safety warnings from an insurance giant and transportation experts, as documented by Helen Santoro and Lucy Dean Stockton at the Lever News site shortly after the deadly crash. President Biden quickly vowed as well that the federal government would pick up the tab for the bridge's reconstruction after the Trump administration had given some $6 million in federal funding to Hogan to support his expansion of the port to allow ultra mega ships, despite both safety and environmental warnings. Some Republicans in Congress were quick to raise their objections to any federal relief to rebuild following the disaster, despite the importance of this major port to the state and to the nation's economy. Some have said the shipping company itself should cover the costs, but the company that owns the ship is now trying to use a 173-year-old law to cap the damages that it may have to pay, including potential compensation to families of the six workers killed in the disaster. The effort, according to Helen Santoro again and Katya Schwenk, comes after big oil and shipping interests, including the company that chartered the out-of-control ship in Baltimore, successfully lobbied to block reforms to this so-called Titanic law. Last week, Grace Ocean Private Limited, the company that owns the ship, filed an action in federal court using the Limitation of Liability Act, an antiquated law from 1851, to argue that the damages it owes for the crash should be capped at $43 million, the remaining value of just the ship and its cargo, despite the fact that by some estimates it may cost hundreds of millions of dollars to rebuild the bridge. That, after champions of big oil and maritime industries successfully lobbied Republicans in Congress to kill reforms to the Limitation of Liability Act that severely limits the damages that the owners of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, for example, were forced to pay following BP's deadly 2010 oil rig disaster. Well, it looks like the Republicans, once again, while expressing outrage, could end up doing the bidding for big business even in this disaster. Joining us now is Helen Santoro of The Lever, who has been digging into this matter pretty much since the night of the initial disaster. Helen Santoro, thank you so much for joining us on the broadcast today, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into some of the details on Larry Hogan's hard press for expansion of the port of Baltimore to specifically accommodate the type of vessels that proved deadly here, despite so many warnings, I want to talk about your more recent coverage of the 173-year-old so-called Titanic law, which may have made sense, as you report it, when it was originally adopted in 1851, but it's a law that has become increasingly obsolete, it seems, and yet impossible to reform. At least it's, and I don't think, well, you'll correct me if this is a coincidence, but it's been particularly difficult to reform since the U.S. Supreme Court allowed a flood of corporate money into our political system in its 2010 Citizens United ruling, the same year as that disaster, the oil spill disaster. And they blocked the reforms that year of the Titanic Law. How has it been reformed or not over its 173 years?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. This law has been around for a while, back at a time when we didn't know what weather patterns were going to look like. And, you know, the Congress wanted to help the country's budding shipping industry. But now things have changed since 1851 in more ways than one.
Yeah.
And there have been some reforms to the law, but very few. And this is not the first time, as you mentioned, that legislators have been trying to reform this law to really bring it up to speed with current, you know, 2024 logistics and ship handling. Actually, the most recent reform that happened was in 2022. President Joe Biden signed into law reforms specifically to repeal this Limited Liability Act for small vessels, and that's marked as passenger boats carrying no more than 150 people. However, although good to have some reform on this act, the Limitation of Liability Act still stands for massive cargo ships like the one that crashed into the Baltimore Bridge. So whether or not that 2022 reform by President Biden will help in the long run with disasters like what we saw in Baltimore is sort of yet to be seen.
So it's interesting that they reformed the bill, at least as it referred to small ships. But when it comes to these great big companies with this incredible lobbying power that they have, looks like you have to go back almost to, well, 1912. You report that outcry about this very law back in 1912, after the Titanic disaster, resulted in the White Star Line having to pay just about $430 for each of the 1,500 lives that were lost in the Titanic disaster. That led to the law being called the Titanic Law. But it did see a number of reforms over time. But it really seems to have ground to a halt in recent years when it comes to these big companies, even though we now have insurance companies that we didn't have in 1851 that ought to be able to cover a disaster like this, no?
Yes. Again, so many things have changed, and it was pretty crazy going back and seeing that people have been sort of complaining about this law since the Titanic crashed in 1912. And yet the reforms have been, I would argue, pretty minimal in terms of just upping the amount that a company has to pay per what they call gross ton of cargo that's being carried by the vessel. But yes, nowadays we have insurance companies, and the whole point of insurance companies is to pay out for big disasters. So again, things have changed since that long ago. And yet still, companies like Grace Ocean Private Limited, that owned the boat that crashed into the Baltimore Bridge, can still use this act to get out of paying a lot of money for a lot of damage and even lost lives. And so a lot of people are, yeah, still trying to fight very hard to get this bill reformed.
And, you know, the reason I started this segment, Helen, with the East Palestine train disaster is because I'm sure you remember it well. It was not just Republicans in Congress, but it was Fox News and all these right-wing outlets just, you know, pretending as if this was the first train disaster that had ever happened. And of course, they happen all the time, and reform has been blocked for years. But we're seeing a very similar pattern here. Had to go back to, I guess this is 2010. You report on the late Congressman John Conyers. He had introduced the Securing Protections for the Injured from Limitations on Liability Act, or the SPIL Act, that after the Deepwater Horizon tragedy, when I'm sure our listeners remember, because we've been reporting on that story as well as the rail story now for years. Back then, after that 2010 disaster, Republican Congressman Lamar Smith, I'm sure our listeners remember him talking about how he was trying to keep the boot of the federal government off the neck of the rig owner, BP, at the time. And reforms against this very bill were blocked by Shell and Anadarko Petroleum, Halliburton, the American Petroleum Institute, the International Association of Drilling Contractors. It was the opposition was led in Congress by Lamar Smith, who now works as a lobbyist for Aiken, as you describe, Washington's most influential lobbying firm, who lobbied against this bill. Am I right that this seems to be a similar pattern where we see these disasters one after another, whether they're on oil rigs, whether they're on trains, on land, whether they are in Baltimore, where we see this outrage that is subsequently blocked from reform by the very same groups who are pretending to be outraged in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as you know, our coverage at The Lever is very much focused on what's the money going on behind these disasters. Mm-hmm. And it's no surprise, although still unfortunate, to see how much big oil and the shipping industry in this case has benefited from this act. You know, big oil has really latched on to the Limitation of Liability Act to get themselves out of paying a lot of money for the Deepwater Horizon fiasco and other issues that have come from these offshore drilling rigs. And it really is. I mean, as you mentioned, Representative Lamar Smith mm-hmm. is now a lobbyist himself. He yeah. also, during his time in Congress, made millions from his Texas oil ranch yep. while also accepting almost $300,000 in campaign contributions from the oil and gas industry. So yes. very much as you mentioned, the Supreme Court ruling in 2010, yeah, there's a lot of industry funding and interest that's big on keeping damage control and the amount they're paying out for damages as low as possible.
And thank you for noting that, by the way, that Lamar Smith himself was and is an oil baron, that he actually makes money himself from his oil ranch down in Texas, in addition yes. to all that campaign contributions he got while serving in Congress, and now the sweet, sweet job he's got as a lobbyist himself with one of D.C.'s largest lobbying firms. Let's talk about Maryland's very popular Republican governor, Larry Hogan. He is now the front runner for the GOP nomination to run against Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen this November. Your piece on the multiple warnings that he received from, a major insurance group, safety experts, environmental experts, Helen Santoro. It sort of reads like one of those disaster movies where all of the warnings from all of the scientists were ignored at the beginning of the movie. In fact, as you report, as long ago as 1980, the Baltimore Sun reported on a top state engineer who warned specifically that a direct hit on the bridge, quote, would knock it down. And that was before all of these large shipping containers were allowed to come into the port, as Hogan lobbied for so many years. What was Hogan told at the time that he was doing that, as he took on this major project to expand the port specifically to allow for these types of ships?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it isn't new news for these bridge engineers and other people, insurance companies, that mega ships can be dangerous. These ships are so much bigger than they used to be. And ports aren't necessarily made to house these ships, and specifically bridges. One of the really interesting things that I found was the most interesting thing from our research mm-hmm. Was that other officials managing the Port of New York and New Jersey, they were told from their engineers that, hey, you need to raise these bridges. These ships are getting bigger. You can't just keep the bridges the same size. So you got to accommodate these mega ships. And they did so with their bridges. Mm-hmm. They raised them. They put a lot of investments into, along with the federal, state, and local governments, also invested more than $1.5 billion into replacing a bridge in Long Beach, California mm-hmm. to accommodate these larger vessels. So it's not as if this information wasn't known. And yet when you look at the 2018 proposal for port expansion in Baltimore, there's a lot of talk about dredging out the canal, making it deeper, how this is going to help the economy, but nothing specifically about the Francis Scott Key Bridge and raising it or anything of that nature, which I found really interesting.
Nothing was done. They did do a lot of safety improvements as to the port, like dredging and so forth. Of course, we should note, as you do, that Hogan also put the lead lobbyist from the dredging industry in charge of the port. Did I read that correctly? Am I remembering that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that was a fun little tidbit that we found as well.
So they did do a number of safety improvements, but not the ones that, you know, would prevent the bridge from collapsing in a direct hit, as we saw here. There was no, I mean, there were warnings about it. How did they make all of these safety improvements, and yet nobody thought to, like you say, either raise the bridge or brace it, or, you know, in some fashion to prevent it from a direct strike like this?
That's a really, I feel like that's the big question. And it's important to note that there, we were focusing specifically on the 2018 port expansion proposal, mm-hmm. but there were other proposals later on, that once Hogan's administration got back to NPR, as we've spoken on NPR about this piece as well, mm-hmm. they were saying, oh, Hogan did support updating pier protection to the bridge. But according to the records, when you look into it from the Maryland Department of Transportation, the work wasn't even projected to begin until 2025. And again, in the 2018, the big proposal for port expansion to accommodate these megaships, there was nothing about helping, you know, making sure these bridges are structured properly to allow these ships to come into port. So it is really the question. Maybe it was money concerns. Maybe they would have taken too long to then allow these mega ships to come in, which bring a lot of economy into the state of Maryland. So that's, I think that's really the question as to why they didn't prioritize bridge safety.
Has Hogan, you mentioned that NPR was able to get some sort of comment from him. Was he able, and I don't think he commented directly in response to your article, at least before you published it at The Lever, but has he spoken to it since? I mean, because these are pretty damning charges in your coverage. Yes. We see year after year after year these warnings happening and these warnings being ignored by Larry Hogan.
Yes. So you're correct that when we reached out for comment, Hogan did not provide a direct comment. He pointed us to a Twitter post about the event, but nothing significant. When NPR Morning Edition reached out to him, they requested their own interview with him. He declined, mm-hmm. though they say that's a standing request on mm-hmm. their part. And it just seems very clear that it seems as if he's really prioritized private interests again and again. He has, you know, a big get back to work slogan, you know, wanting Maryland to be this point of business. And it seems like with prioritizing these private interests, the safety of the bridge was clearly just not considered, as seen from 2 weeks ago with this collision.
Yeah. I mean, he's pointed to the expansion, or at least he had been. I bet he won't be doing it much anymore, but he had been pointing to the expansion of the Baltimore port as one of his, you know, campaign lines that, you know, we made Maryland about business. Look what we did to the ports. Look what we're doing now, because it's a huge port, or at least it was. It is obviously now shut down because, in no small part, Larry Hogan ignored the warnings about this expansion. Now, Helen, have questions about his failure to heed those warnings made their way into the Senate race yet, as you have seen? And if not, would you expect that to be between now and November?
I haven't seen, that's a really good question. And I haven't seen it getting into a Senate race, though I sort of hope it does at one point. Yeah. I think this is a big lapse in judgment. You know, obviously there was a big economic reason to want this port to be such a big thing for the state. You know, it was one of the top importers for cars and agricultural machinery. But I hope that people bring up the safety concerns that it seems like former Governor Hogan was just continuously not taking into account over many years.
Just one example, the Hogan administration's 2018 port expansion application included implementing safety requirements, but it did not make any adjustments or designate protections for the nearby Key Bridge, which the ultra-large crafts would be traveling under. Meanwhile, his port administration said the project had, quote, few and well-mitigated risks. But as the port expansion was nearing completion, Alliance, the insurance conglomerate, sounded another alarm that while safety improvements such as deeper dredging would help to accommodate these ultra-large vessels, the size of existing ports had not changed, increasing the chances of, quote, a direct hit by, quote, ultra-large container vessels. I mean, that sure seems damning, and if it doesn't come up in the Senate race, it sure seems like, political malfeasance to me. I know that Congress has been on vacation, Helen, for the past 2 weeks, pretty much since the bridge collapsed. But do you have any sense of whether or not they will step up to President Biden's call to cover the cost of the disaster? And yes, Larry Hogan's call to do that. I mean, this affects not just Baltimore and Maryland, but frankly, the entire national economy in truth, no?
It really does. And I really hope that there's more conversation around that. We've been covering, keeping our eye on it. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Congress has been on vacation, but it just really seems to harken back to what we were originally speaking about with this Titanic Law, a real protection of business interests. While not really considering public interests or the public funding that's already gone into just taxes that are making these bridges, and then these big businesses are coming in, having these collisions, not listening to safety concerns, and yet the government is sort of expected to then foot the bill as opposed to the big shipping companies. I can't say for sure which way this is going to go, but obviously, me and my colleagues were following it very closely, and I can say that I hope that there's a little bit more, at least a little bit more pressure on these big companies to foot the bill.
That would be nice. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Congress finally back for the first time after, really, since this crash, and to see which direction this all goes. Helen, really appreciate your coverage over at The Lever on this. Helen Santoro is an investigative journalist at The Lever. She reports on political corruption, check, corporate greed, check, and also in the U.S. healthcare system, check, 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 and other sectors. Prior to The Lever, she wrote for a bunch of different places, New York Times and others. Helen, really appreciate your work here. Hoping to follow it as it moves forward, because I think this could get busy in the next few weeks and certainly in an election year. Please stay in touch, and love to have you back as it moves forward.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much, Helen Santoro. You can also follow her work at levernews.com and on the Twitters at levernews. All right, we have got to get out.
Yes,
my thanks to, I know, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doy, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com, a service made possible by those of you who donate at the blog or stop by bradblog.com/donate to do exactly that. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter. I am The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you, who drop by bradblog.com/donate.